What we're seeing with the Trump administration is they're going after people not because they committed a crime, but because of things they said.
Hi there, it's WAMC News Director Ian Pickus. And on this episode of the WAMC News Podcast, we catch up with Vermont U.S. Senator Peter Welch. Well, here in May, members of the Republican majority in Congress are talking about approving President Trump's, quote, big, beautiful bill sometime before Memorial Day. Whether that's possible and what it will entail remain to be seen. I caught up with Vermont U.S. Senator Peter Welch to talk about that and so much more. Here's our conversation.
Good to be with you, Ian.
So I want to start off by asking you about this Washington benchmark we've just passed, which was President Trump's first 100 days. How are you thinking about that milestone and what you've seen from the administration so far?
No, unfortunately, I think the worst is yet to come. I mean, what Trump has done is, number one, this is on the positive side, he's identified some problems. Number two, what he's done is come up with solutions that make the problems worse. And as he's come up with solutions, what he's chosen is kind of a lawless way to proceed. And that's the thing that is the most worrisome. He's just completely disregarding the limits on the authority of a president. Things like firing people, impounding money, doing things that were declared illegal under Nixon. And he doesn't care. Second, his approach to things like with DOGE is not to address waste, fraud, and abuse, as he says, because all of us, I mean, who do you know? You ask anybody, nobody's for waste, fraud, and abuse. But unlike when Clinton did a review of government, they did a plan, they assessed the situation, and they shrank the government workforce by 300,000 people. What Trump is doing is a firing first and aiming later. So DOGE comes in with Musk, and they just fire people. Sight unseen. They send out emails. So what you have is kind of a destructive rampage. The other thing is that these tariffs that he's imposing, and it really feels very much like it's an arbitrary setting of tariffs, are doing real damage to the economy and are going to do long-term damage to the erosion of our strength economically. And it's starting to hit places all over the country, including very much Vermont. And I don't see that, and this is the forecast that is alarming to me. Trump now is surrounded by folks who've taken a loyalty oath to him, who it's like a fervor that they have to work his will. So he doesn't have, even within his own administration, sober minds that are willing to tell him he's going too far. So I'm concerned very much about what he's done and where he's going.
Now, you've outlined a lot of different policy areas that I'll follow up on. But in the meantime, you know, for that 100 days, there were a lot of polls taken, and they found that President Trump's, you know, popularity, which started relatively low, is down pretty sharply. I'm wondering, do you think that matters at this stage? You know, he's in his second term now. Will it have an effect on how Congress approaches dealing with the White House if they know that his popularity is trending in the other direction?
Well, ultimately, public support is everything. Public sentiment, as Lincoln said, is everything. And what we have now is a situation where the Republicans in Congress are terrified of Trump. If he tweets against them, they think they lose their election. And what they're showing right now is total devotion to whatever it is Trump says they support. What they have to face is the reality that what Trump is doing is hurting the people they represent. And at a certain point, a lot of my Republican colleagues are going to have to make that choice. Are they going to go down with the ship with Trump, or are they going to declare some independence when they see the impact, say, of these tariffs on jobs in their own community? We'll see. But I don't think the plunging, the polls are down. In fact, Trump has less support at this stage in his presidency than I think anybody has had as president at this stage. So that's going to matter ultimately. But right now, what I'm seeing in Congress is a blind dedication to the Trump agenda.
So you've mentioned the tariff policies, and obviously you represent a border state. What have the effects been on industries in Vermont so far?
Well, first of all, it's not just Vermont. Canada is our biggest trading partner, but that's true with 35 states. So it is a hugely important partner to us. And of course, traditionally, we've had a very good relationship. We, not just Vermont, but the United States has a very close relationship with Canada, with the cross-border activity. And of course, we've had the USMCA, the US-Mexico-Canada trade agreement, that has served us very well. These tariffs are hurting our farmers. Like, they import fertilizer. Price has gone up about 25%. That's a killer for farmers operating on very short margins. Our manufacturers import the products from Canada, the steel, and it's really hurting them. Our tourism industry has been absolutely hammered as a result of the tariffs and also the insults that Trump has hurled at the so-called 51st state and the so-called governor of Canada. That stuff is gratuitous and really, really harmful. So we're seeing impacts every day in Vermont from the president's tariffs and his rhetoric.
Now, what did you make of this sit down with Trump and Mark Carney, the new prime minister of Canada, which, as you say, comes amid some pretty wild rhetoric from our side of the conversation?
It looks like it was cordial. And, you know, it's his pattern. Trump is very bombastic in his rhetoric, and then when the person is sitting in the office with him, he tones it down a bit, and he did that.
Well, unless you're Zelensky.
Well, exactly, which is a separate topic and really appalling what I think the president, J.D. Vance, did to Zelensky. But on the Carney meeting, it was cordial, and that's about the best we could hope for. But the tariffs are still in place, and the damage is still being done. And, you know, what I'm doing is talking with a lot of my colleagues, including Republican colleagues, who do see that the tariffs are very damaging. And also, this brings up another core question for Congress. The Constitution gives Congress the authority to tax. And the whole point of that was that the House of Representatives, and that's where it starts, they're closest to the people. And people don't like to get taxed. And there has to be a very good reason to do it. What Congress has done is delegated this taxing authority via tariffs to Trump. And my view, and I've gotten some Republican support for this, is that we have to recapture that tax authority. There was a delegation to the executive decades ago when it was thought that it would be used in a genuine national emergency, not as a willy-nilly negotiating tool or leverage tool as the president wants to use it. And we got about four Republicans to support us on that. So I do see some cracks in that Republican unanimity, at least in the Senate, if not yet in the House.
You have a bill to repeal the tariffs. Are you hopeful that that will gain any momentum right now?
It's gained some momentum. I mean, we on one resolution had 51 votes. So we're getting some support in the Senate, and we've got to keep pushing on it because this goes to the fundamental question of the separation of powers and checks and balances, something that Trump has run roughshod over. But the likelihood of that getting passed, where it would require a vote in the House, which is still totally on board with yes to Trump, no matter what it is, or passed a presidential veto, is a really uphill battle. But I think it's really important that we keep asserting this, because I think the more it becomes very visible to everyday people, the damage that these tariffs are doing, and this is self-inflicted damage. You know, this is not something beyond our control, like, say, COVID or even, you know, the housing crisis in 08. This is a explicit policy enthusiastically embraced by the president that is the cause of what is continuing harm to our economy.
Senator Welch, I want to ask you about a very interesting case. You actually met with a man, Mohsen Mahdawi, who was detained by federal agents, and there's a lot of question about the legality of that. What's the latest on that case?
Well, first of all, the immigration issue is obviously a very important one. And this is a place where there has been progress by the Trump administration in securing the southern border. And of course, at the end of his administration, Biden finally addressed that and really slowed the cross-border traffic. And that has continued during the Trump administration. So there's a lot of support among all of us to have a secure border. And secondly, there's support to deport criminals. But what we're seeing with the Trump administration is they're going after people not because they committed a crime, but because of things they said. Moussa Madawi has been here 11 years. He actually lives in Vermont, very close to where I live. And there's no accusation that he did anything of a criminal nature. He was at the Columbia protest, and he has a history, as I understand it, of working for peace in the Middle East. And he was arrested when he presented himself voluntarily for a citizenship interview. And after the interview, he was told to wait a minute. And then ICE agents came in, put him in handcuffs, arrested him, and they were taking him to Louisiana, but a court order kept him in Vermont. And I visited him at the St. Albans prison. And then shortly after that, he had a hearing before a federal district judge who released him on bail. But what this is an example of is a person is being who's been here 11 years, who's committed no crime, who was arrested and threatened to be deported. Remains to be seen what's going to happen because of what he said. So the Trump administration, like on a lot of things, it just goes too far. You know, we saw in the Garcia Abrego case, a person was arrested, taken out of the car with his 4-year-old son and put on a plane and sent to a notorious prison in El Salvador without any hearing whatsoever. So, you know, my view here is that there's a real consensus in the country, Republicans and Democrats, about the need for border security, about the desirability of, in fact, deporting criminals, but not authorizing the government to pick people up because they don't like what they said.
You know, and we've talked about this on previous shows earlier in the administration. Obviously, you know, you have an eye on this from the Judiciary Committee, but there is a question that's emerged now, which is if a judge tells the administration to reverse course and the administration says it's not happening and the plane's not turning around, what happens then?
Well, that's the constitutional crisis that we're lurching towards. You know, this is the whole system of checks and balances. And, you know, it's interesting because most people take it for granted that we have a system of checks and balances. It's not as though we as U.S. citizens and Americans are entitled to have expectations like the peaceful transfer of power. Of course, that was challenged on January 6th, or that the rule of law prevails. And part of that, of course, is that when the court, which is the branch of government that decides on the legality and the constitutionality of a presidential action or B, congressional action, that the court will be given deference and everyone will accept that ruling of the court. Trump is not doing that. And of course, you've heard comments from him. You've heard comments from J.D. Vance that judges who make decisions they don't like should be impeached. So that is extraordinarily alarming. And even Chief Justice Roberts, who's very careful and very cautious, says impeachment is not a tool to dispute a ruling that you don't like. And that's where we're headed with President Trump. And I'm very, very concerned about it.
There's a somewhat related issue, which is the other day you were questioning the president's nominee to run Customs and Border Protection. So what are your concerns and questions about Rodney Scott's nomination?
Well, Rodney Scott has a lot of experience, so I have less concern about him than I do about the Trump policy. As I mentioned, we've got to secure the border. We can deport criminals, but they just picked up 8 people who had papers and were working on a farm in northern Vermont on a dairy farm. We've got to milk our cows. So what are their priorities? Are they going to be rounding up agricultural workers in Vermont and around the country, where it will do immediate and long-term damage to our agricultural economy? That is what I was asking him about. Now, he doesn't get to set the policy, so this is not about him. This really is about the administration. And my view here is we've got to have border enforcement, and we've got to deport criminals. But we also have to have a sensible immigration policy so that, just in the case of agricultural workers, we've got to milk the cows. It's that simple. So why are you going on the farms and picking people up? And, you know, the farm in question said that they had all the proper documentation and paperwork. And a number of those workers who've been picked up have already been deported. So that causes me great concern. And I was trying to raise the point about making sensible distinctions on the immigration policy, the ones I've just been talking about with border security, the deport criminals, but ag workers, is that really where we want to do an action that's going to hurt our farmers?
Well, it sounds to me like you did not get a satisfactory answer on that policy.
Well, I didn't, and I didn't expect I'd get it from him, because his job is to carry out the administration policy. So I was making the point that a lot of us in Vermont have been trying to make, that we have been working hard to have, for instance, an agricultural visa. And that's on the president. You know, he's the one who has the authority here to set what the policy is. So if he has ICE agents running around picking up people because they don't like what the person said, not because of a crime, or going on the farms and picking up workers who are really essential to the well-being of our agricultural economy, I think that's wrong. That if he's picking up criminals, and they can be deported, I would support that.
I want to follow up on another issue we've talked about a lot over the years. You've had your issues well spelled out with Postmaster DeJoy and his oversight of the USPS. And now there's word that President Trump is going to name David Steiner of the FedEx board to be Postmaster General. Do you know anything about him? What are your thoughts?
No, but my thoughts are that we've got to have a much improved postal service. And we were very disappointed with DeJoy because he seemed to have a singular focus on cutting costs and cutting costs by reducing service. And our postal service has been around longer than the country's been around. I mean, before the Constitution, we had the Ben Franklin-inspired postal service. And it's gone through, you know, real challenges that have arisen as a result of technology, you know, the telegraph, the telephone, and of course now the internet. But the Postal Service has always been vital to the well-being of our country, particularly rural America. You get to now these days get medicine delivered, get packages delivered. So my hope is that, and this would take some congressional cooperation, that we have a plan that is focused on the restoration of good service for folks across America, as opposed to this focus on cutting costs, cutting services, and making people wait 3 or 4 days before they get their mail delivered.
Senator, this is our first conversation since the decision by Minority Leader Schumer to go ahead and vote to keep the government funded. And you decided to vote the other way. And I noticed you were quoted at the time saying you could really understand both arguments. Schumer, the Democratic leader in the Senate, has taken a lot of heat for that decision since that time. So do you still feel good about the way you voted? And what do you think? Was he right? Was he wrong?
Well, the reason I said it was a very tough call is that you want to keep the lights on in government. I've never been in favor of a government shutdown. And the reason I voted against the continuing resolution is because we're not in normal times. What Trump is doing with his overreach, with this disregard of constitutional norms, is, in my view, extremely, extremely dangerous and unique in the time I've served here in Washington. So these extraordinary times, in my view, justified an extraordinary action, and that was voting against the continuing resolution. And the merits of the continuing resolution were terrible because there was, again, relegation of authority on the budget to President Trump that he'll abuse. So instead of Congress doing line items, which is our job, it basically gave the president a lot of power to move money around, take it away from things he didn't like, and put it in the things he did. And that's a real abdication of congressional responsibility. So those are the reasons that I voted against it. But here's the reality that has to be acknowledged, even by those of us who voted no, and that is a shutdown can do harm to real people because it means that you have government services halted. And I understood where Senator Schumer came from, because that's a place generally I've been in. But it was these extraordinary times that motivated me to vote as I did. I think we're making progress now in the sense that there's real Democratic unity about opposing Trump. The folks that, you know, America is looking to us and a little frustrated that we're not able to push back as much as a lot of people think we should. And that's a frustration I share. You know, we have 47 votes in the Senate and the Republicans have 53, and they're pretty much in lockstep. But on the other hand, I think the actions we've been taking against the tariffs, I think some of the visible things that somebody like Cory Booker did with his 25-hour speech, you know, I think these are giving some sense to America that we are fighting back. But I also think that what you're seeing with these demonstrations, the May Day demonstrations and others, are showing that the American people are speaking. And that ultimately, the public sentiment is the fact that's going to make the most difference.
During the first Trump administration, I remember you talking a lot about how you thought you had some area of agreement with the president about the cost of prescription drugs. And now, here in the second term, you've got a bill with Senator Hawley, a Republican colleague, to lower prescription drug costs. So the issue is still here. What's different now?
Well, I did. You know, the bill I have with Senator Hawley, a conservative Republican, is to have what's called international reference pricing for the drugs we buy. In my view, it's been a scandal that Americans who, by and large, pay for the research that goes into creation of some of these life-saving drugs that are then marketed by the drug companies, we pay the highest prices in the world. You know, we pay for the research. We have the infrastructure for it. And then the drug is sold for a price that's 3 or 4 or 5 times as much here as it is in Canada, as it is in Great Britain, or it is in France. So Senator Hawley and I are saying, hey, wait a minute. Let's get the international price, which is going to be a lot lower for Americans, not have us be suckers. That is something I talked to President Trump about in his first term. In fact, you know, in the first 3 or 4 months of his first term, and he explicitly advocated for having us stop being the sucker on drug prices. But regrettably, there was no follow through during the first administration. So I am really happy to be working with Senator Hawley because this just makes common sense that we pay not a higher price when we do so much of the payment for the research, that we pay at least the average international reference price. And I think we've got some wind at our back on this now.
Let me ask you about another one of your colleagues. I think it's fair to say that John Fetterman is a friend of yours, the Pennsylvania senator. And there's been some reporting of late about really erratic behavior on his part. He's defended that and said he's not leaving the Senate. You were quoted as saying you're concerned about him. Have you had a chance to talk to him? And what's your view?
Well, I have. And John is a friend. And I think he's a unique talent. I think he's got a plain way of speaking that really resonates with a lot of everyday Americans. And he won an extraordinary race in Pennsylvania. You know, here's the reality. He had an incredible medical event with the stroke during the campaign, and he overcame that. And then he had depression, and he was for a month in Walter Reed, and it helped it immensely. But obviously, when you have a major medical event, there's the follow-up care that you've got to get, and you're always going to have a challenge to make certain that you're being healthy. And I had dinner with him about 3 weeks ago with Katie Britt, and we had a really good time. And he was focused, and he was engaged, and he was my friend. So I can't speak to what the other reports are, but what my view is, as a friend and as a colleague, and who sees him as a trusted senator and a gifted one, I want to do everything I can to help him. So I'm hoping to get together with him very, very soon, and saw him just yesterday, and we just had a good but casual and short conversation on the steps of the Capitol.
So one more thing, Senator, my wonderful colleague, Pat Bradley in Plattsburgh, covered a rare appearance by you and Capital Region Congressman Paul Tonko, and that was in New York's 21st congressional district, where you came to talk about threats to Medicaid as Congress keeps working on the President Trump domestic agenda, the big, beautiful bill. There's a lot of questions about what will be in there. What is the fate of Medicaid given the current conversations right now?
It's in danger. I mean, Trump wants tax cut. That tax cut is going to be paid for according to the instructions given to the Energy and Commerce Committee by reducing Medicaid by $880 billion. That's astonishing. And what that means is that two out of three folks who are older and in a nursing home, their beds are paid for by Medicaid. They could be kicked out, literally. Children, and especially children with disabilities, their health care is based on Medicaid. And, you know, parents who love those kids and do everything they can for their wonderful children, they have no chance of being able to have anything close to a normal life for themselves or their kids if they lose that Medicaid support for their disabled child. And then you go beyond just the individuals who are so severely impacted. Our community hospitals, and that's true across rural America, whether it's a red state or a blue state, they get hammered because then they're going to be asked to provide care for free. And they can't do it. They're on tight margins and financial stress. So for the life of me, I just don't understand why there'd be any focus on cutting access to health care as a way to pay for a tax cut, especially a tax cut that essentially is very beneficial to very wealthy people and to our multinational corporations.
Is it your expectation that they will, you know, House and Senate will be able to get on the same page and pass the bill? I mean, I know Speaker Johnson was talking about Memorial Day as a possible deadline. Does that seem likely to you?
Well, let me be clear, Ian. I am against this bill. I mean, you know, they're talking about this bill as though it's a big, beautiful bill. Nobody in Vermont talks to me about that tax bill. They talk to me about the rule of law. They talk to me about the tariffs. They talk to me about the high cost of housing. They talk to me about how they can't afford child care and they're trying to figure out how to get to work when they can't do that. They talk about how they take care of their elderly parents. I haven't had anybody that's coming up talking to me about this so-called big, beautiful bill. People know it's not going to make the slightest difference in their life dealing with the things that are really essential. Like paying your bills at the end of the month, like being able to afford an apartment and afford the rent. They know there's nothing in this for them. So I'm just totally against this bill because it makes no sense and it does nothing to benefit the hardworking folks in Vermont and hardworking folks around the country.
Okay, that does it for this episode of the WIMC News Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. Until next time, I'm Ian Pickus.